This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday, Governor Phil Scott presented his budget to the legislature. During his address, he laid out the general tenets of the level-funded budget to members of the House and Senate.
Today, I present a balanced budget that does not increase taxes or fees, does not make program cuts that impact Vermonters in need, and matches base spending with base revenue, not one-time funds, to avoid future shortfalls. In fact, base spending in the general fund for the next fiscal year will be below base spending for the current one. I deliver this balanced budget while investing in economic development, education and training, and housing for all Vermonters. My budget makes important investments in fighting opiate addiction and cleaning up our impaired waterways.
Well, today we're going to discuss the proposed budget in broad terms and drill down on some very specific elements that the governor offered. And we're going to do it with the chairs of the Senate and House Appropriations Committees. Appropriations is where decisions are made about how much money goes into each bucket. So these committees will now be diving into the governor's full budget and coming up with recommendations to take to the full chambers. Kitty Toll is chair of House Appropriations. Jane Kitchell is chair of Senate Appropriations. They both live in Danville. Actually, they are sisters. And they're with us today to share reactions and next steps. Thanks very much for being with us. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So I'd love to get first your really broad reaction to the budget. And then, as I said, we're going to talk about some of the specific elements that Governor Scott included. Senator Kitchell, what did you think of the budget overall?
I thought the budget presentation actually presented some dimensions that we've never experienced in budget deliberations, and that has to do with the policy shift of certain areas of education-related spending into the education fund, which has been a significant percentage is funded through property taxes. So when Act 60 was passed, there was a great deal of concern about having those kinds of expenditures put over into the Ed Fund and the impact on property taxes and what that would mean locally. So from that perspective, the budget proposal as it relates to the education fund, redefining it, adding expenditures that historically have not been there, was a very, very significant departure from the parameters that were set forward when that statewide funding mechanism was enacted by the legislature.
And the feeling in your gut when you said this was a very big change was, you know, what was that feeling for you?
Well, for those of us who have been on appropriations, the one part of the budget, and it's the largest area of spending, is the K through 12 appropriation. Unlike the other areas of spending, where the Appropriations Committee makes a decision, those decisions on spending are done locally. What we do is move the money and appropriate the necessary dollars to support those locally determined budgets. This budget proposal, in essence, is putting us in a position of spending money yet to be determined revenues or savings, because to balance the budget, about $50 million of spending for investments as well as for parts of the teacher's retirement are being moved into the education fund. So that is a whole new way of looking at budgets, and that is spending money in anticipation of decisions that will be made by every voter who goes to vote on their local school budget.
Representative Toll, what about for you? What did the budget address feel like and sound like to you?
I was encouraged by many parts of the budget address. I was happy to hear about more investments in higher education. Our state colleges have been struggling over the past years and need to morph into a different system that attracts more students. And so the investment there, I was very encouraged by. I also was encouraged by the investments in early education and early child care, because we know that young children their education starts the day they're born, or even many will say before that, and to undo the damage or not the experiences that they should have early on, it's hard to undo that in later years, which we see a huge pressure on children in our public school system. I was very happy to hear the governor supporting water quality in Vermont and supporting the Treasurer Pierce's two-year plan. And I was also encouraged with affordable housing, from homelessness to young working families, making more investments there, as well as in his inaugural address, he did mention affordable health care for every Vermonter. Those are all very encouraging statements that I think that we can all embrace and get around. I do have concerns with the water quality piece beyond the two-year plan. There is a huge financial burden to clean up all of Vermont's waters, and there was not a plan that was mentioned in the budget address regarding water quality. And as Jane mentioned, his proposals around education, I have great concerns if this can be done in the timeline that he has given us, what the impact will be in the outer years, what it does to our smaller schools and our smaller communities. And, you know, that's what I see mostly living in the Northeast Kingdom are the smaller schools.
Listeners, I'd love your perspective. We're taking a look at what was in Phil Scott's budget address yesterday and talking about what happens next with the chairs of the House and Senate Appropriations Committees. If you heard the governor's speech yesterday, what did you think? What was your reaction? And maybe you've been hearing the reverberations already about what might come down for school budgets, level-funded school budgets, changes to the health care premium that teachers are expected to pay. We'd love your perspective. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Catherine, who wrote in to say, obviously, there are a lot of different interests at play when it comes to the budget. Can you talk a little bit about how you and the committee start to set your priorities for the budget? Senator Kitchell?
Well, our first step is to, the Senate acts on the budget after it comes from the House. Budget and tax bills originate in the House. So we've got the benefit of the work of the House Appropriations Committee. I think many of our priorities are the same as the governor's. The question might be how you get there. Certainly the emphasis on protecting vulnerable Vermonters, particularly our children and our seniors, the other values that are there around health care, and many of the other parts of what the governor proposes. Certainly we're all concerned about the opioid addiction, and we have actually doubled the amount of the number of Vermonters in treatment to 6,000 at any right now. So that shows an ongoing commitment to do what is right to protect our children and so forth. I think one of our priorities is around government and accountability and performance. And I will personally say, for the last several years, I've had a bill to reorganize the Agency of Human Services. It's half of state government. I think the last decade has indicated from the public perspective they're very troubled by it. The management of the exchange was another example. And I believe that we have an organization that is too large for one person to manage. It controls half the state budget. The functions and programs are very diverse. And so while there have been some proposals around some much smaller organizational changes, I think if we're looking at where the money is, where the concerns have been, where a great deal of attention needs to be given to how we operate programs, how we improve outcomes, I believe that that is the area that we should go to if we really want to look at how a major agency does its work and how we make it more accountable.
Governor Scott, in his budget address, said he would look to cut 14 positions in AHS. I'm curious if you've talked with new AHS Secretary Al Gobay about the idea of maybe moving some things out of his purview and really changing things.
I've made it very clear, and I have communicated to the secretary, and actually this is not a new discussion, and it's to create an agency of healthcare administration. It's the second largest area of spending after K through 12. It's hugely complicated when you're talking about delivery and payment reform and everything from public health, health promotion, right up to our most expensive chronic illnesses. So that's a huge task in and of itself. And then when you overlay child welfare and corrections and benefit programs, the diversity and the complexity that are all lodged in one organization, I think is probably very impossible to do well. That's my assessment.
Let's go to Robert, who's calling in from Jericho. Hi, Robert. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment. I think Governor Scott should be commended for addressing the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is our education system, which is, frankly, has to be right-sized. We have the lowest student-teacher ratio in the country. We spend the most per student in the country. And yes, we have a number of small rural schools. I've served on school board for 12 years. I'm very familiar with the challenges that this budget presents. But if we want to do anything, whether it's funding Lake Champlain cleanup, making the state more affordable for young adults, there are a number of priorities addressing the opioid crisis. I agree with the comment that we have to go where the money is, and I don't think that we are threatening educational outcomes by moving, however small, in a small way, towards the national average in student-teacher ratios. I think the governor didn't address that directly in the budget, but the notion of teachers paying 20% for health care is a small step. And I think telling school boards that they cannot have a blank check from Ontario is a first step. We have to right-size the public school system if we're serious about funding other priorities in Vermont.
Robert, thanks for your perspective. Appreciate hearing it. Kitty Toll, certainly one of the priorities for the House Appropriations Committee is going to be looking at this education proposal from the governor pretty immediately, I would presume, because one of the things that he would like to do is give school boards a little bit of extra time to come up with their budgets and have everybody in the state vote on one day, May 23rd, mm-hmm. instead of town meeting day. But still, it doesn't give school boards much time to figure out what actually is happening. Are we doing the budget plan we had thought we were doing? Are we trying to come up with a level-funded plan? So what is your approach and response to Robert there on how you craft and look at this idea of education funding?
I appreciate Robert's concern for right-sizing, and I thoroughly understand that, and I understand our numbers. What listeners need to remember is we've had this budget less than 24 hours, and our committee has just started testimony with the agency, not the agency of the administration, to understand the impact that this will have. The timeline seems to be the real problem here. I think every Vermonter wants the best, most affordable, most rewarding educational system for our children, for all of Vermont's children. And we are working with a very old system. We have a 5-week turnaround time with the governor's proposal in order for school boards and budgets to be passed at town meeting or for there to be a delay in the budgets. And if we're just starting our work today, and it's not impossible, it's an extremely aggressive timeline, we have to have the input from the policy committee, which would be education. They need to take testimony. It would also go to ways and means because there's tax implications here. It would also come to appropriations because there's spending implications here. We would want public testimony because we always want to hear from Vermonters. And then it would have to come to the House for a vote. It would then have to go to the Senate, go through the same process. If we completely agree with the Senate, then we could, you know, vote on the Senate's proposal and it would go to the governor. But if we don't completely agree with what the Senate does, it goes to a committee of conference. And for this whole process, for input in policy committees and Vermonters to all have a voice, 5 weeks for a major change in the education policy of the state of Vermont is almost unrealistic, and to do a very, very good job. I have heard from one of my superintendents, and our budget is going to the printer. And for the entire district, each of the entire supervisory union, each of the district's budget is ready to go to the printer. And their work, he told me they had over 1,000 cumulative hours in putting these budgets together. And to start fresh at this timeline, you know, with this timeline, there's too many unknowns. What will the legislature do? Do we need to start fresh? Do we hold on with what we have? If we do need to start fresh, what do we do about the work we're doing to comply with Act 46? Do we put that on hold? But, you know, that was an initiative we wanted to move forward on. And so it creates a whole host of problems.
So do you think, I mean, realistically speaking, is there any way that that could move forward this year, given the timeline that the governor would like to see budgets not presented on town meeting day, but budgets presented on May 23rd? You know, is it possible to make all those changes and let school boards know?
It's always possible. It will be very difficult and almost unrealistic to do it in a 5 week time period. The additional problem is if we do not do this change, there will be a significant hole in the general budget for fiscal year 18. And so waiting until town meeting for policy committees to make a determination how to move forward, it slows our budgeting process down, which pushes everything out. And so the timeline is very problematic.
We're going to spend a couple more minutes on this education proposal before we move on. But I want to mention here that we will be talking much more in an in-depth way on Friday about this specific part of the budget and what the implications might be, how it would actually work. So don't worry. We are going to talk more about this. VPR's Bob Kinzel said yesterday that this was sort of a bombshell. So we will be talking about it more. Let me take a call from Andrea and then Senator Kitchell. I want to get your response as well. Andrea is calling in from Huntington. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I am the chair of a local school board, and I think the idea that budgets are going to be redone and that boards have not spent the last 4 months working their budgets is a little naive. In our case, we flatlined our budget 2 years ago. We had cut a teaching position, and in return, we replaced all the windows in our school, and it became a flatline budget. Last year, we cut our budget for our grade school. We are a 25% free and reduced lunch community with 2,500 people in our community, and we belong to a supervisory union. This year, we are replacing our HVAC system. It's 50 years old. The interest payments are $30,000 for a half year of interest. There are inconsistencies in the policies of the legislature and the governor in that they want reduced carbon, and we are going to an HVAC system that is a ground source system, which is reducing our energy usage by about $20,000 a year. But then we are supposed to have a flat budget and not have a new HVAC system that is energy efficient.
So, Andrea, safe to say, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of details involved here, but safe to say you don't like this part of the governor's proposal.
I think it is unrealistic to think that the school boards are going to be able to. I mean, what's Williston going to do? Stop their $19 million bond issue. As far as things that could be cut, one of the other large aspects to our budget besides the HVAC system is special education. And there are requirements for special education that are federal and state mandated.
Well, Andrew, let me stop you there and turn your thoughts over to Jane Kitchell. And again, we are going to talk a lot more about this on Friday, so I don't mean to cut you off. But just for the sake of right now, as we look at what's happening right now, Jane Kitchell, I know you wanted to jump in.
Well, I wanted to say two things. First of all, I think what the caller is talking about, everyone would like to reduce the cost of education. We've certainly had a shrinking student population, but how you bring that infrastructure and spending down is a complicated task, and Act 46 is an attempt to do it, and there's a lot of work underway. The other thing I would just want to point out is, do we have a hole in the budget, or are we going to end up raising taxes? Because if the school budgets don't come in level funded for whatever reason, and there are a whole host of reasons where that might be the case, then that will translate into an increase in the property tax. And every $10 million of spending is a penny on that tax rate. So to move $51 million or $50 million of spending for the higher ed initiative to the child care and the early ed.
These are other things in the governor's proposal.
Right. His proposal is to move that spending into the education fund and have it have no impact by virtue of level funding budgets and the 20% for health care premiums. If that offset, in fact, doesn't materialize and the spending has been authorized, then that's the policy choice that has to be weighed out. Do we put those education-related spending into the Ed Fund if that moves forward and the offsets are not there? Then we are talking about creating a situation that violates the governor's principle of no taxes or fees, because it will the inevitable fallback in this zero-sum game is the property tax.
Well, certainly we're going to have to see what happens as that develops. And I don't want to shortchange the conversation on education funding. Again, more on this to come, certainly in the next few weeks, not only as the Appropriations Committees look at it, but as Vermonters start to take a look at this proposal and weigh in. We are taking a look at what was in Phil Scott's budget address yesterday and getting reaction from the House and Senate Appropriations Chairs. And from you, we'd like to know what you liked or disliked in the governor's budget. Level funding, no new taxes or fees. Can the state meet its needs while doing that? We've been talking about making some changes to school budgets and asking teachers to pay more of their health insurance premiums. Another proposal, closing the Windsor prison, creating a drug prevention czar, increasing funding for child care. If you want to weigh in or ask a question of Kitty Toll and Jane Kitchell, call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with the chairs of both Senate and House Appropriations Committees, Jane Kitchell and Kitty Toll, respectively. We're going over the budget address from Governor Scott yesterday and getting their reactions to what was in it, particularly on his interest in shifting and cutting various areas of state spending. If you have a thought about what you heard in the speech, or if you want to ask Senator Kitchell or Representative Toll a question, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. In his address, the governor said that he would make sure to protect the most vulnerable Vermonters, but he said he would do that while also making cuts to the Agency of Human Services budget. A couple of the things that he'd like to do: cut 14 positions within AHS, cut payments to hospitals. In corrections, he'd like to close the Windsor facility, which he says is the most expensive male facility in the state, increase electronic monitoring, and earmark an extra $800,000 for the Guardian Ad Litem program. Representative Toll, do you think that we can actually cut the costs, cut the budget in human services, and still protect needy Vermonters?
You can cut the cost in human services maybe at the administrative level. I would not suggest cutting the cost of the on-the-ground workers who are providing the services to Vermonters, especially in DCF, where we have seen what happens when you have not enough caseworkers with families in need.
And there wasn't necessarily a suggestion that those 14 positions would come from any particular department at all, right?
No, okay. We're waiting to hear the details. The devil is always in the details, and that information is still forthcoming. But another big piece when we talk about human services is the risk of loss of federal funds with the unknowns of what's going to happen in Washington. We have a total state budget that last year that was passed at $5.7 billion. And of that, 35% of the budget is federally funded. And of that 35%, $1 billion is Medicaid, and $400 million is human services. And so if there's loss of federal funds coupled with, if there are major changes in state funds, we could have an entire service that is at risk for Vermonters. And I didn't hear any plan yesterday of what we do with the loss of federal funding. And it's very difficult to plan for the unknown, but it's something that we have to keep our eye on because it could have a devastating impact on a state like Vermont that relies so heavily on federal funding.
And not just in human services, right? I mean, we're talking about environmental cleanup, transportation,
right.
Yeah, so
water
education.
Right, education, water quality. The majority of it is in human service and in Medicaid, but also in transportation and then dappled all the way through state government.
Senator Kitchell?
There's no question that Vermont has really used the Medicaid funding source to advance its health care reform initiative. And so even before the passage of the health care legislation, we had done more to provide health care coverage. So the impacts could be very different. If you go to a block grant arrangement, which is one of the proposals, the history of block grants in this country is dismal. There's one block grant, for example, hasn't been increased since 1996. So when you factor in inflation and when you're dealing with it in healthcare, where you have a rapid growth that right now still the cost exceeds revenue growth, you're going to have tremendous financial pressure. So the prospect of a block grant is it would be very difficult. It would give you money to begin with and flexibility, but the ability to manage out your costs would be extraordinary. The rollback of the ACA,
the Affordable Care Act.
Affordable Care Act. We have close to 60,000 adults that are getting health care coverage because they can qualify under that Medicaid expansion provision. If that goes away, or there's been discussion around some of the other things that could be done by executive order, if Planned Parenthood is not going to be able to provide women's health services, and it's a major provider of health care in a preventive way, and it's a major service provider, the question would be access. The Affordable Care Act has moved a lot of money into the healthcare delivery system. Probably the DSH payment might be the least of our concerns, to be honest, simply because of the way revenues have flowed into hospitals and the reduction in uncompensated care.
On the question, what you just said is a little bit terrifying, so I'm just going to leave it there, this question of federal funding and the unknowns and how much the state actually receives in federal funding, and we don't know yet. So,
no.
Let's put a pin in that for the moment. But this question of human services in some of the areas, I'm curious what you think, Senator Kitchell, about the idea of closing the Windsor prison. We know that the state of Vermont is going to have to renegotiate a proposal for any out-of-state prisoners we have. There's long been a conversation about can we move prisoners back in. Does closing the Windsor prison make sense to you?
It's been proposed before, and it was rejected last year. There was a proposal to close the work camp in St. Johnsbury. The Windsor camp is more expensive. It begs the larger, longer-term question about our facilities. We have a community correctional facility arrangement, and many of our facilities are old, they're aging, and we have property capital improvements that are several hundreds of millions of dollars. So the question really becomes one of longer term, what do we need for a replacement facility? What would it look like? And so we'll be looking to our judiciary committees to take a look at that proposal. Electronic monitoring, Senator Sears has been a proponent for moving to electronic monitoring for a long time. We would like to see that move forward. That part was good. I think our track record on supporting opioid treatment and prevention is well established. So I think that's another area where there would be agreement in the treatment and public protection area.
Representative Toll, one of the other things that Phil Scott talked about in his address was that he had looked at Treasurer Pierce's recommendations for how to fund waterways cleanup. That's a 20-year plan. The first 2 years are what Treasurer Pierce has called a glide path. And for Vermonters who have not invested much time in looking at her plan, I invite you to go listen back to our program with her earlier this month, where she goes into detail on what is actually in the plan. The 18 years after that initial 2 years is a mixture of fees, taxes, revenue sources. Phil Scott has said he can do it without raising fees and taxes, but didn't seem to provide a plan beyond those first 2 years. What are you thinking?
A plan was not outlined in his budget address yesterday, and Treasurer Pierce has been clear that the two-year glide path using existing bonding capacity would raise about $50 million, 25 each year, and that this would give us the opportunity. She has a couple of plans in place to get us for the next 18 years. However, the plan that the Treasurer has in place does include raising revenue, and the governor has taken a hard stance in not raising revenue. To put it into perspective, the 20-year costs, these aren't hard costs, they're estimated costs. The total need would be $2.3 billion to clean up Vermont's water. Our water is an important piece of infrastructure for this state. We have to have clean water in this state, in this country, in this world. And so the cleanup effort has to happen. But finding $2.3 billion over 20 years, she has identified that there's approximately just over $1 billion in ongoing identified revenues. The gap piece is $1.25 billion. In unknown revenues over the next 18 years if we choose to do the glide path.
The other thing that we're going to be looking at is that the source of the pollutants is varied. And so and there are multiple agencies, state agencies that are involved. And right now we don't have a spending plan. And, we probably could put millions of dollars into water treatment plants, but they're only 3% of the, contributors. So we need to have a spending plan that's strategic. Where would you go first? What watershed? What particular area? What activities would you fund? So that we can be strategic in how we take what money we have and make sure that we're getting the biggest return. And so I think in Senate appropriations, one of the things is it's not just a matter of the revenue, but how will it be spent and how will those interests get weighed out so that we are using the money in the most effective way possible.
Kitty Toll, you and Jane Kitchell are sisters. You commute together back to Danville and to and from. I'm curious if you think your close communication as chairs of these very important committees is helpful, or is there any way in which it might hinder the two different committees working?
I think that we both have made it very clear that my priorities are the priorities of the House and Jane's priorities are the priorities of the Senate. I think communication is a good thing. I don't influence her. She doesn't influence me. It's quite often I'm the one going to her for information because she has a great depth of knowledge from being a former Secretary of Human Services. And so, when I first was on appropriations, I was constantly asking, how does this funding source work? How does this work? And that was very helpful. But we each have our own chambers to work with, our own set of priorities, and mine will be the priorities of the House and the members in that chamber.
Well, we look forward to seeing what each of your committees comes up with, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more as the weeks progress. Kitty Toll is a state representative from Danville and chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Jane Kitchell is a state senator from Danville and chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Thanks very much to you both.
Thank you.
You're listening to Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The election of T.J. Donovan as Vermont Attorney General left his former seat as Chittenden County State's Attorney vacant. Last week, Governor Phil Scott's choice for that position was sworn in. It was Sarah George, formerly a deputy state's attorney in the Chittenden County office. George also works weekends as a waitress in Queechy, saying being a waitress makes her a better lawyer. Sarah George is here now to talk about her priorities in her new office. Sarah George, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So I want to ask you why you wanted this position and what your priorities are for it.
Yeah, I've had a lot of people unsure whether to congratulate me or give their condolences. And it's a big job. It's a big job with really big shoes to fill, you know, succeeding T.J. Donovan. I wanted the position because I've been a deputy for 6 years, and which in the deputy world is actually a pretty long time. There's a lot of turnover in this department or in any public service work, as you know. And, you know, there's policies being made every day by people higher up that affect how I do my job and how our process and our system works. And in order to really be a part of those communications and those decisions, this was the best position for me to be able to do that in.
T.J. Donovan has been known for programs that he's put in place to divert people facing criminal trials from the prison system, court diversion. Is that something that you plan to continue focusing on?
Yes, absolutely. All of the programs that T.J. implemented or helped grow are really incredible feats, and I fully intend on not only continuing to support them, but to see what I can do to make them even better, stronger, and see if there's any way to come up with additional programs as well.
Well, to that end, what do you have in mind when you say maybe additional programs or strengthening the ones in place?
Well, you know, for example, I think that we could even do more to strengthen our law enforcement direct referrals to the Community Justice Center. So for first-time offenders on low-level misdemeanors or, for example, retail thefts that are maybe minimal in, you know, a $20 shirt, for example. Is that really worth the resources of bringing to us and then us sending to diversion? Or could those cases all go to the CJC first? And then, you know, on second offenses or higher theft amounts, maybe come to us and then we'll send to diversion. So things like that. I think that doing some sort of community court is a big task to take on, but I, you know, we're looking into that, which would be incredible for the state. Getting treatment courts in other counties, if I can help implement that, I think would be really great.
After you were sworn in, you spoke specifically about tackling the opiate addiction epidemic.
Yep.
What are you thinking there?
Well, a lot of that goes hand in hand. Certainly strengthening our treatment court and getting treatment court in other counties, I think, would make a really big difference. And some of this stuff, you know, I don't know yet how to do because I haven't been a part of that communication. So I need to meet with a bunch of people to figure out what I can do before I decide what I'm going to do. But getting more funding for RIC, if that's what needs to be done, or getting more prescribers on board to get more people into treatment sooner, things like that.
Are there other issues that are not directly related to criminal cases that you plan to take up? So, you know, whether they're civil cases or other issues that are important to Chittenden County that from the position of state's attorney you can amplify or elevate or work on that you have your eyes on already?
Nothing that I can think of. I think that, you know, there's certainly things that are law enforcement issues that we are not always involved in, but that we are going to take a part in, like the getting more direct referrals. So we won't ever be a part of that, but we can be a part of the discussion in getting that implemented or getting that started. I think that there's probably stuff that I will focus on, but right now I'm very focused on just getting our office kind of in good working order so that we can then, as an office, do community outreach with law enforcement or community groups to strengthen the relationship between us, which will then hopefully better the community and better our office without it actually being a prosecutor role.
You've mentioned communication with law enforcement officers a couple of times now. Do you feel like it is not currently strong, that line of communication between the state's attorney's office and law enforcement officers in Chittenden County?
I do. That's certainly been something I've been told during the seeking of this position, that law enforcement feels like they're not being heard. And that's something that's very important to me. I think that, you know, our law enforcement officers are putting their lives on the line every day and putting a lot of hours into the cases that they're sending to our office, and that once they get into our office, they feel like that communication is not reciprocal. And so it's something that's really important to me to try to instill in all of the deputies that they need to continue that communication through the life of the case and including the disposition of the case, whether it's being dismissed or a conviction, or, you know, those things just need to be communicated to the law enforcement officers. If it was dismissed, why? If the court dismissed it, what can they do differently next time? Or if it was a conviction and they did amazing work, and do it again. Anything. You know, this isn't saying that they're going to like every decision that's made, but they deserve to know what it was.
One of the things that you just mentioned is your deputies, and one of the deputy state's attorneys just resigned. Is that a position that's going to be refilled?
Bram's position?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, I'll have to fill it. I mean, he's the chief deputy, so it's a big position to fill, and I also have my position to fill, and Dennis Wegmans, who recently became the Addison County state's attorney, he was here. So I have that position to fill as well.
So a lot of administrative to do right at the beginning as well.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was talking before about. I have a lot of work to do within my office. And a lot of it, you know, I'd like to do quickly, because being down three deputies is a significant hardship on our office. Our caseloads are huge as it is, and the longer we're down deputies, the more work it is on the rest of us.
That's Sarah George. She is the new Chittenden County State's Attorney. Thanks for joining us, Sarah, and good luck.
Thank you so much. And again, thank you for having me.
The comments in Monday's discussion about women's marches on Washington and Montpelier keep coming in after our show on the subject ended. So we've put together a few of them, and Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen is here now to read them with me. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Jane. Let's start with Pedro, who wrote in about the march in Washington. She said, I am in my 70s. I got a ticket at the last minute. I marched for my mom, who, born in 1902, was a suffragist. I am transgender, male to female, out and proud. I felt only total acceptance both on the bus down and back and there in D.C. I walked the length of the mall and, looking in all ways, saw people raising their voices. It was awe-inspiring.
Glenn says, I accompanied my wife on the march in Montpelier. We carried our banner, Love Thy Neighbor, No Exceptions. It felt like a movement of movements. By that I mean so many issues are interwoven, as Bernie so often highlights. The underlying theme to the movement of movements concept is a concern for the common good, the realization that we are all in this together.
Cynthia wrote in to say she actually doesn't think the events were as inclusive as some claim. Human rights issues affect conservatives and liberals alike, she wrote. Yet often when someone opens their mouth to share a more traditional perspective, their views are not welcome. Tolerance is a buzzword that gets tossed around, but is rarely extended to those who disagree with abortion rights, gay marriage, and LGBTQ aggrandizement, or to those who still support upholding our country's immigration laws and decreased governmental control.
Cynthia goes on to say, whatever happened to liberty and justice for all? Whatever happened to civil disagreement? Where did unbiased reporting of the news go? Saturday's event was not a women's march. It was a march for liberal ideology. We need all American voices to be listened to, not just those that preach love and inclusivity, as long as it complies with the current popular agenda.
Catherine in Charlotte emailed, I'd like to thank David, who called into the show today as a Trump supporter. It took a lot of courage, and I think his points were very important. It can't be stressed enough that we are all people, and in many ways want and need the same things.
And Jinx from Northfield, Massachusetts, wrote in with an answer to the question of what next, saying, please remind your listeners to put their federal, state, and local representatives on their speed dial. The amount of callers really matters. We need to keep hammering. This movement is here to stay. Call about any and all human and civil rights.
And please remember to keep Vermont Edition on speed dial or the email equivalent of speed dial. Call during the live shows at noon or write in with comments anytime. You can reach us at vermontedition@vpr.net, online at vpr.net, or on Facebook and Twitter.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Jane.
All right. It is pistons, pinions, and parking brakes tomorrow on Vermont Edition. We'll discuss the state's new vehicle inspection system coming to a garage near you in March. Department of Motor Vehicles Commissioner Robert Ide joins us to discuss the changes. And you can email your questions or comments about the new inspection system to vermontedition@vpr.net. And be sure to listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.